but it's Wednesday, hump day. You are tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And I don't know about you, but last night was painful. I stayed up. I was a good doobie. I stayed up to watch the debate in Iowa. I needed to do that because our two guests are going to be we're having on today are going to be touching on the debate from last night because I made them watch it too. But what can I say? I kind of miss Cory Booker and Andrew Yang, and there are some people who just they change the conversation on the debate stage. They're more upbeat. They're a little perky. They're a little more emotional, and not only do they bring out sort of a different je ne sais quoi because they're there, they actually change how the other people relate to each other on the stage. I just felt it was an exchange of sort of vanilla and a little unfortunate. And, of course, what happened between Bernie and Elizabeth is equally unfortunate. And I'm going to say something, you know, being the first girl to run for governor in state history. And, of course, there had been, no, let me just say something. There had been two other women, I believe, that ran. One ran as a libertarian. The other one ran as, I think, as a communist. So there had been other candidates that had run for office. But what I want you to know is that these the first time I ran for office, I was terrified. And the reason I was terrified was not that, you know, that I wasn't going to be an effective governor, assuming I won. But my big fear was, what if I lost? Because I was the first woman to run on a major party platform, would they say that women were not capable of running and winning? And I guess here's the great news about being the first girl to run and having lost, is that women did not lose in 1992. Arnie lost in 1992. And virtually every other woman that's run for higher office has won, except for one of the more recent candidates who was kind of also a little bit more milquetoast and wallpaper. And we knew she was going to lose before she even started running because she was being talked into it, which is not the best way of running for higher office. But I just want everyone to know that is – there is always this sort of tension between is it women that are losing or does this particular woman lose because – of the nature of the politics of the day, whatever. I just wish Bernie and Elizabeth would have not gone there. And I'm a little annoyed at Elizabeth because I think she understood what Bernie may have said to her. And I think to use that against him was actually not fair. All right. And he may be somewhat sexist, but then again, so are all of us a little bit sexist. All right. So before I grab our guest, let me do this. I just saw an article, and I wanted to at least read you one sentence from this article, and then I will grab Bob Hennelly. It was entitled, Meet the Money Behind the Climate Denial Movement. Nearly $1 billion a year is flowing into the organized climate counter movement. This is just really important because, you know, we think that we understand what's happening around us, but we have no idea how we're being infiltrated with misinformation and things that are basically trying to bias us against the facts that are actually presented. And real quickly, according to Brühl's research, there are 91 think tanks and advocacy organizations and trade associations that make up the American climate denial industry. They pull down just shy of $1 billion each year. The money is used to lobby or sway public opinion on climate change and other issues. The grand total also includes funds used to support initiatives unrelated to climate change denial, as explained in a quote by Brühl given to The Guardian. Since the majority of the organizations are multi-focus organizations, not all of this income was only devoted to climate change activities. But the anti-climate effort has been largely underwritten by conservative billionaires, often working through secretive funding networks. They have displaced corporations as the prime supporters of these think tanks and advocacy groups and industry associations, which have worked to block action on climate change. So in other words, you can be angry at the corporations like ExxonMobil and whatever, but instead the people that have made money on ExxonMobil, the billionaires, are now able to use this money in a dark way and a non-transparent way. And therefore, they spend $1 billion a year misinforming you. And the problem is, you know, you'd like to be a shareholder and do a stockholder derivative action against a company. And then you find out the company says, oh, I know nothing. Oh, I see nothing. And it turns out it was the billionaire that did. All right. So joining us right now is someone who I have to tell you, Bob, you are an amazing writer. And I want to talk to you a little bit about last night's debate, which was, for me, very painful. But your piece, Reconciling Dr. King's 1968 Dream and Our 2020 Nightmare, is one of the most depressing, powerful, poignant, profound pieces I've read in a long time. And I read it, and then I sat back, and then I had to reread it. And I just told one of the producers at the station, I'm going to read every word of it out loud on Friday, because I know we're going to talk about it, but I want people to hear it. And I want to repeat sentences, because they need to hear it again and again. Because I just thank you for doing it. That's all I have to say. I'm still emotionally, wow. I'm drained by it. And I'm so proud I know you. So
well, yeah, and I'm drained by it too, but I do feel that we have to be doubly committed to be worthy of his legacy.
You're right.
And one of the things that struck me strange about that painful exercise that we all engaged in last night, the civically engaged, was the way that CNN does this thing, and all of them are the same in the sense that they trot out the word of socialism.
Right.
And then they ask Bernie, are you aware that Americans have no stomach for socialism? And they conveniently never mention how Dr. King felt about democratic socialism.
Right.
And don't reference any of his writing that brought into stark relief the current crisis that we're in the midst of with such prophecy. I mean, and there's just one short.
Yeah, are you there? Oh, I'm losing you. You're going in and out. Where are you? Bob? Hello?
So
I don't know where you are, but you're going in and out. Are you moving around or are you in a basement? Tell me where you are.
No, I'm stationary.
Okay. All right. Well, stay right there. Now you're back again, but we keep losing you. I don't want to lose anything. Okay, keep going.
Okay, great. So this is a quote from Dr. King's book, the last book he wrote. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered.
Right.
And that was, you know,
stunning.
Well, many years ago. And here we are.
So I took exactly that quote and I put it on Facebook. I took exactly that quote and I put it on Twitter. I took exactly that quote and I sent it to a friend of mine at Slate.com. And I mean, that quote is just, it almost needs to be on a billboard in Times Square.
Right.
Let me just share something else with you. So after having read your piece, I listened to last night's debate and I was so depressed by it. I also did something else. I wrote, defining structural racism in America. Now listen to these two facts, because this again relates to both the article you wrote and as well as what we did not get in the way of content last night. You know, the threat of socialism, but not the idea of what Martin Luther King did, which was really sort of a talk about the kind of capitalism he saw that we were creating and what that would mean. And he did believe in democratic socialism. He actually saw that as an opportunity to actually address the issues of America, but to actually move us collectively forward. So listen to this. I wrote, defining structural racism in America. Here are the two statistics. The mortality rate for babies born to black mothers with a master's or doctorate degree is far worse than the mortality rate for babies born to white mothers with less than an eighth grade education. A black woman is 243% more likely to die from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes than a white woman. And I then wrote, imagine if a candidate for president began every speech with these facts. Repetition is a powerful teacher.
Absolutely. And one of the things that is not, and that's what makes the reporting, we've talked about this in this space before, one of the problems is the disconnect between the way our circumstance as a nation, as an economy, is described to us. So when we look at the the image presented on the CNNs, the MSNBCs, you pick it, Fox News, it is of this great prosperity.
Right.
And so the circumstance you describe might as well be on Mars. And so similarly, the Democratic Party is in this situation where it has now tethered itself to this notion of whomever gets the most campaign contributions and shows up in polling gets access to the debate stage.
Yeah.
So this is, and this contradiction where the party that is supposedly the one thing they all have in common that they give lip service to, even Uncle Joe, is the notion of the 99% need to be served and the 1% need to be held accountable in terms of wealth concentration. They've created a sweepstakes which makes it a much easier place for white billionaires. That's what Mr. Perez has accomplished.
Yeah.
They don't, the networks don't want to go into this critique because they're part of this system that is creating clicks and commercial opportunities. But what you are not seeing, what you're seeing in these debates is the progressives pitted against each other.
Right.
No discussion. I didn't hear last night from anybody that the United States in within a year or two will be spending more on debt service.
Yes. The military budget.
Than the annual, right. Oh. And so what's happened in this country at every level of governance,
right.
And I've been covering municipal finance since I was 17 and I'm 64, they have created a mountain of debt at the municipal, county, state, and federal level that is now spilled over like lava from Pompeii into our households.
Yes.
And I suggest that we think of debt as social control. What better way to control the future of the nation than tell folks, because what happens to this debt is their investment opportunities, their ways of hiding through tax exemption, the wealth you've accumulated.
Uh-oh, we're losing
in
you
the
again.
System.
Okay.
That's it. You'll be back?
Yeah, you're back.
I have to stay in a very tight
routine. Yeah, you have to see, you can't, yeah, exactly. You can't move your arms and you can't move your legs.
Right. Yes, right.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, so the other thing is, do you know what happened after the debate last night? Were you paying attention? You weren't channel surfing, were you?
I know. I caught the whole thing with inferring what the body language meant, and then they
I turned to The Late Show. Guess who was on Stephen Colbert right after the debate? Michael Bloomberg.
Outstanding.
Oh, my God. So I started screaming at the television set because, of course, let's remember, Michael, our $54 billion billionaire who also owns a media empire known as Bloomberg News, has decided to skip the first four primaries because he doesn't need it. And he keeps reminding everyone, I could not qualify because I wasn't able to get the requisite number of contributions because I only have one contributor. Me, he kept saying. Just me. Not anyone else. I don't need anyone else. But what was so amazing is the brilliance. I almost wanted to give Stephen Colbert a knuckle sandwich because what Stephen Colbert did was give Michael exactly what he wanted. He was then bigger than the group that was on that debate stage in that pathetic debate. He had more time, frankly, to talk than any of the people on the debate stage. And his $54 billion and the fact that he's already beginning to poll in different places gave him access to what? To one of the prime spots on The Late Show Stephen Colbert.
Arnie, let me ask you a question.
All right, I'm ticked.
Stephen redeemed himself. Did he ask him if he's going to disclose his federal income tax return?
Oh, I don't know. Did he ask him that? I don't remember if he asked him.
That would be a public service.
It would be.
No one seems to want to do that.
Yes, they're all afraid. Well, you know why.
I've asked him that question, and we've talked about that on this air as well.
Right.
But evidently, we have the precedent of the orange one in the White House who didn't have to, so I guess that's a path to all billionaires.
Yeah.
But I suggest to you that the way that Michael Bloomberg has pulled together his fortune through this vast array of interlocking international LLCs, some domiciled in Delaware, some in the Caribbean island, while all perfectly legal, deserve an examination, because indeed it is the amassing of that wealth that creates our current problem with the concentration of wealth and and income inequality.
So let me also say something else. As I was watching Michael last night on the Colbert show, and that was that in a way, Michael Bloomberg is exactly like Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump, because he was a ratings god, got billions of dollars in free media. So
right.
To a larger and even before he appeared on the stage running for president, he already, as someone said yesterday, this is a great line from me, I forgot about it. I said before people were looking at the different Republican candidates running for president, Donald Trump was already in their living room. And the reason why he was already in their living room was because he'd always had access to you through The Apprentice, through whatever. So he was familiar. He's always been covered by the media. He's always been a persona by the media. He's always, I mean, it's like he's our well-known bad guy, you know, the whatever. But everybody knew him even before he ran for president, and then he became a ratings god. Well, what you're seeing now with Michael Bloomberg, Bob, is that his $54 billion is now giving him access to a free media strategy. So not
right.
only does he buy the time, and that means that every single major, you know, news outlet and network and whatever is going to genuflect, because how many millions is he going to spend on their network, but then it then creates this free media, and you saw it last night with Colbert.
Well, I would suggest that what you will see in the corporate declarations of the publicly traded media companies, which everyone should familiarize themselves with, you'll even see a prediction that thanks to the largesse of the 2020 campaign, Reid, a.k.a. Michael Bloomberg,
right.
and Tom Steyer,
right.
we will see an increase in revenue. So there is a direct connection
yes.
between this blasting media onslaught and the corporate news media. It's what winds their watch. It's what raises the price of their shares. And it's a thing we need to hold accountable. Over the last many years, we've had media consolidation where remember a quaint notion that a broadcast license was considered a privilege,
right.
not a property right,
right,
and it belonged to the public. How quaint.
Well, it
and
was.
Now it's been
yeah.
turned to a property right.
So I mean, again, when I was so disappointed in Colbert for doing exactly what played into Michael Bloomberg's hands. I mean, it was like, why did you do this? You know, I used to have some sense of respect. He knew exactly why Michael Bloomberg.
Well, he wants Mr. Bloomberg back.
Of course he does. And he wants his money and he wants his ad content. Come on, we already know this. So let's talk a little bit about what happened yesterday. I mean, they started off talking foreign policy, and basically they actually didn't talk about, as we look forward, there was no forward conversation. Everything was about the past. And then when they started talking about all the other issues, I just felt like, no, there was not one level of content coming out of anyone. And it was so depressing because I understand that they wanted to be Iowa nice. Let's also remember that's part of the problem. This was being done just before the Iowa caucus. And there's this perception that Iowans don't like people that, you know, that jab and are more obnoxious, that are willing to sort of take out another candidate. But this was the most content-free debate I think I had seen to date.
Well, and I think that this also, there's a lack of understanding by the media that's there about the actual circumstance economically on the ground in Iowa.
Yeah.
The fact that Iowa is Exhibit A for the change that happened in the heartland after 8 years of hope and change with President Obama, many millions of Americans lost their homes, and they live in places that people who are in the I-95 corridor in Silicon Valley may not be familiar with,
right.
but indeed in MLK boulevards and in main streets across America, you can see the carnage of ruin to this day. And yet it's not reflected because we're in recovery. And so the challenge for candidates who are trying to be progressive is to describe the alien universe that is the United States on the ground right now.
Yeah.
And so that means that you have to remind people, as did, you know, there was some real talk, I don't know if they did it last time, but we've had, and it bears repeating, a decline in average American life expectancy for the third year in a row. Suicide, opioid, and alcohol.
Suicide among farmers. Suicide among farmers, Bob.
Out of control.
Yeah.
People in Iowa are making $7.25 in the minimum wage. A recent United Way examination found that 40% at least of Iowans are struggling month to month. But they're not clickbait. They're not going to be buying a Viking cruise, and hence we ignore them unless we are fortunate enough that they're motivated in their misery and debt to organize and vote.
So one of the things that I saw last night was how in some ways disengaged Joe Biden was on the debate stage. And I mean, there were, you know, where they I guess they have little lights that turn yellow and then red, and that means that it's the end of your 2 minutes or whatever it is.
For he went to his corner. Yes, he did.
Well, not only did he go to his corner, but he'd say, oh, I see the yellow light. Like, wait a minute. Most people needed 4 minutes in the 2 minute segment. Joe didn't even want to talk for 35 seconds. It was like, you know, I mean, I have another minute and a half to go before I have to stop. And I am looking at this performance and I'm looking at him paying attention to the lights and I'm looking at what he is saying, which for the most part was word salad. And I keep thinking, I understand that people are familiar with him. But how does that familiarity work when you're standing against Donald Trump? I just saw someone who was so disengaged and so not assertive, and I'm thinking, how does that play out if he wins the nomination? I am terrified, and last night maybe even more terrified.
Well, and I think that it ends up in the reelection of Donald Trump.
Oh God!
Now, who would be unhappy about that? I also think that I know Eugene Robertson has won the Pulitzer Prize. He should win another one just for that phrase, word salad.
Yeah.
Because it does really describe the fact that, and it's helpful because you can't see it in the prize fight that's the Democratic Party right now, but in Mr. Biden's corner is a totality of professional corporate Democrats who are there giving him smelling salts, anticipating his mistakes, ready to apologize for whatever happens, and to find virtue where there is just really a very slow and sad performance.
Well, so I'm looking at Axios, and there's a comment here from a professor who says, I don't think Biden had a great night. There were, again, times that I was, well, confused as to precisely what he was talking about. Now, can I just remind everyone, I understand if you're running for dog catcher and you say, I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about, or, you know, he doesn't have a strong night. We are talking about someone who is running for president of the United States. How can you say that? He didn't have a great night. I didn't know precisely what he was talking about. I couldn't follow him. We are talking about someone that you want to have go against Donald Trump, our liar in chief, who makes crap up, you know, by the second, confuses you by the moment. And I am thinking, and they keep creating these apologies for him or but for him. In any other setting, Rob, he would not be on the stage. He would have been gone before he even started.
Right. Well, and I think as long as he makes sure to, I think it's down to every fifth sentence, President Obama, that's key, and then African-American in their mix. And so that's all he has to do. And then that reminds the pundits who were watching him, who were validating his performance, to say those same phrases. And so as a consequence, I mean, I'm waiting for someone that we might have had that was Kamala Harris that stayed in the mix, if Cory Booker had stayed in the mix, someone to remind people that African Americans suffered perhaps more than any other group out of the Great Wall Street heist, where Wall Street basically consumed and gobbled up $20 trillion of household wealth that destroyed millions of American households in a generational way that now has handicapped millions of families who used to be able to offer, let's get real here, someone who's been serving time, who wants to turn around their life and could go to their grandmother's home, a person of color, to live, to find rhythm, to get their life back. Those places are gone. In some places, they're empty. In other places, the very same predators have bought them and arranged them into rental properties where they're selling, get ready for this, rental-backed securities.
What's a rental-backed security?
Well,
please educate me.
What you've done is, like mortgage-backed securities,
okay.
Remember that?
Of course.
Well, what we've done is, since we've pushed down the population to serf status, so many people into rental status, with this consensus that, you know, perhaps the concept of home ownership was too grand. Maybe we need to dial it back. So then you buy all these homes as rental properties, and then you chop up these things into securities, individuals and institutions from around the world invest in rental-backed securities. And then you speculate on them and create derivative products just like you did last time. And because no one is paying attention, you bring it all down again, and we all say we didn't see it coming.
All right, I'm going to need to let you go, but I just, I was writing.
Was that too depressing?
I just wrote a friend, and you know, because of the 2008 economic meltdown, I have not recovered from it because I am just so appalled, and I'm so appalled that Barack Obama basically sort of completed what George Bush wanted him to do. I mean, it was like the idea that anything changed, nothing changed with Barack Obama, especially as it related to Wall Street. And I know we're not supposed to trash Barack Obama, but when it comes to Wall Street, I'm sorry. He's not going to be forgiven by me. But the one thing I beg everyone to do as we end this conversation, if you have not seen the Academy Award-winning documentary, Inside Job, I recommend that you see it almost once a month. And you should actually bring friends in to see it. Because in a lot of ways, what you just described is Inside Job par deux. Okay, with the rental-backed securities. I just want everyone to know it has not gotten better. It has gotten bigger and worse, and there's more accumulation of wealth, and there's a greater gap between rich and poor, and Wall Street controls more of it. What did they say after the economic meltdown? The banks own this place. Sweetheart, they still do. And I think if you see Inside Job, and then you look at what Donald Trump has done to aid and abet the very wealthy, the first thing you know you need to do is remove Donald Trump. You have to.
Excellent.
And on that note, thank you, Mr. Henley, for writing for Salon.com.
I'm at Stuck Nation, by the way.
At Stuck Nation, we put that all up on our website, so you got
excellent,
it.
Excellent, because we are.
All right, take
so
care.
Much. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. That was the day that black labor leader A. Philip Randolph issued a call for a march on Washington. He proposed the march to bring attention to the employment discrimination faced by African-American workers. World War II was being waged across the globe. U.S. industries were booming. Tanks, planes, weapons, and munitions rolled off production lines. From 1941 to 1945, the United States would export more than $32 billion in goods as part of its lend-lease program to Allied forces. It was also becoming more and more likely that the U.S. itself would enter the fighting soon. Thousands and thousands of workers found employment as demand for labor soared. The young aircraft industry saw a staggering growth of more than 13,000% during the war. But many black workers found themselves shut out of many segments of this growing economy. The Lockheed Aircraft Corporation, to take one example, had zero black workers on their assembly lines in 1941. A. Philip Randolph had risen to national prominence with his successful organizing of the Black Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union. Now he turned his attention to war industry discrimination. He declared, "Negro America must bring its power and pressure to bear upon the agencies and representatives of the federal government to exact their rights in national defense employment and the armed forces of this country." He continued, "I suggest that 10,000 Negroes march on Washington, D.C. with the slogan, 'We loyal Negro Americans demand the right to work and fight for our country.'" His declaration helped to launch a movement. His call for 10,000 marchers grew to a call for 100,000. The threatened march successfully pressured President Roosevelt to issue an executive order to desegregate war production. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In a theater of Virginia Tech, audience members are invited to stand with eyes closed and imagine themselves on a beach, wading into the ocean. But then this relaxing visualization takes a turn. Their guide, performer Daniel Bird Tobin, asks them to imagine they're still standing in water, but not on the beach. They're in floodwater that's inundated the university drill field, bookstore, and graduate center.
All places where, on a 100-year flood scenario, you could have waist-deep water.
Tobin's presentation, called Flooding the Beach, is based on maps and data by Virginia Tech researcher Peter Sforza. It's part of a larger effort to help people connect with science in a more visceral way.
I think people learn, truly learn on a deep level when they're able to find a personal connection to research. And poster presentations are fantastic at getting a lot of clear data out there. But sometimes when you are able to use performance or other art forms to communicate science, people can find a emotional hook that brings them into the work.
So Tobin aims to get people's bodies, emotions, and minds engaged with climate science. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Report from 29 District. The revolution will not be televised.
I think I like this song. The revolution will not be televised. Okay, Carolyn, who sings this? Or who I don't know. This is not singing. This is rapping, I think. But anyway, so who does this?
Gil Scott-Heron.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Well, you know, here's the problem is that the revolution will be televised because we all have cell phones. Okay. I mean, unfortunately, technology has changed this. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And it is January 15th, Wednesday, the day after the Iowa debate. And joining us by phone from Washington, D.C., someone I've known since he was a child, practically. Dave Leventhal is the editor-at-large at the Center for Public Integrity. And Dave, before I grab you, at the end of my conversation, I was talking to a reporter from Salon.com and at Stuck Nation. His name is Robert Hennelly. And he wrote this amazing piece about sort of what Martin Luther had predicted. And everything that Martin Luther predicted, especially in his last book, has come to pass. And I said at the end, he was talking about the new sort of derivatives and new sort of products that are not mortgage-backed products, but now they're rental-backed products because no one is buying houses, but now everyone has bought up all the rental units, and now they're using this as part of the derivative packages. And as he was talking and I was getting more and more depressed, I suggested to my audience that everybody go out tonight, go on Netflix, do whatever, and get a copy of the Academy Award-winning documentary Inside Job. And did you ever see that, Dave? Did you ever see that documentary?
I have not, Arnie, so maybe I'm going to have to take your advice as well.
No. The reason you're going to – I'm just going to tell you right now. So I just Googled it because here's what happened. I was asked to moderate a panel in the Midwest, and it was a full-day panel on the economic meltdown. And when they invited me to moderate the panel, I said, fine. And then when I was about to show up the night before, I asked them, I said, can you send me the list of all the different people that I'll be speaking? Because you hadn't sent me the completed list. And it was everyone that was either an apologist for Wall Street or worked for the industry. And I am looking at this list and I'm like, I'm not coming. And they said, excuse us? I said, I'm not coming. And I said, this is not a balanced, informed conversation. This is so skewed to basically, you know, excuse Wall Street for their bad behavior. There is no one like Elizabeth Warren on the other side to at least give some sort of counter arguments. So the guy said to me, oh, Arnie, that's your job. And I said, no, you hired me to be the moderator. My job is that's not my skill set. So Inside Job had just come out maybe a couple months before.
So I told them that I would not come to the campus to moderate the full-day panel unless they publicly showed inside job on campus. I said, if you don't show it and at least give them another sense of what happened here, I will not come.
And what was their response?
Well, at first they were like over a barrel because how could they replace me? It's a short order. And at the same time, just like you, they had not seen it. So the head of the economics department said, okay, I will go find it and I will put it on for the school. He called me up the next day. He said, I've just watched it 3 times. I said, isn't it a shame? It took my threat for you to see it. And let me just read you the opening line from the New York Times review. As I was watching Inside Job, Charles Ferguson's meticulous and infuriating documentary about the causes and consequences of the financial crisis of 2008, an old archaic sentence kept popping into my head. The words come from the second chapter of The Scarlet Letter and are spoken in frustration and disgust by an old Puritan woman who watches Hester Prynne publicly disgraced but without any sign of remorse, making her way from Salem's prison to a scaffold in its supermarket square. She, quote, has brought shame upon us all, the anonymous woman remarks. Is there not law for it? An inside job shows the story of Wall Street. They have brought shame upon us all. It is one of the most amazing, powerful discussions and documentaries I've ever seen. And the reason I bring it up, Dave, is that in a way, as we go into 2020, and you wrote this piece about how Donald Trump is not going to have to worry about any campaign finance violations because there's no one to enforce it, and you kind of look at what's happening, the story of Inside Job really gives you a sense of what was the foundation for where we are today. It explains not only what happened to the economy and the gross inequality, it also, to some extent, explains how we elected Donald Trump. So I'm
and
just going
to Ernie, yeah. I'd be remiss since you brought this up to not shamelessly pitch a series that we did back in 2013 at the Center for Public Integrity called After the Meltdown, which is very much on topic with what you just described. Won lots of hardware and prizes and whatnot, but basically was a look back at the 2008 financial crisis and where everyone was 5 years after, including all of the banks and mortgage lenders and whatnot, who had gotten in so much trouble, or so we thought.
Right, exactly. And again, if you have that series after the, you almost need to bring it back and do after the meltdown and sort of see today in 2020, despite the fact that we think that we have sort of rehabilitated the economy of the lowest unemployment and all this stuff, yada, yada, yada. And yet what you find out is so many people are still either running in place from where they were after that meltdown, or to some extent they've even slid, which is so shocking given the nature of what we think the economy is. And that is part of the rationale behind Donald Trump taking 700,000 people off of food stamps. It's part of the rationale for what Donald Trump wants to do with Social Security, disability, all these things. In this great economy, how can you still have any needs? Well, you find out a lot of people are incredibly needy because they've never recovered, which is just amazing. So Inside Job, I'm begging you, watch it, then send me a little note after you see it, because you will understand what you did in 2013. This really sort of mirrors that story as well. So
duly noted.
All right, so I spoke to our first guest and sort of asked him to respond to last night's Iowa debate. I'm going to start with you. What did you think of last night? I thought it was somewhat dissatisfying.
Well, you know, I think everyone is expecting with any of these debates that there's going to be some monumental flashpoint that's just going to change the nature of the whole race, and we're suddenly going to think differently about any number of the candidates who are up on stage, even a reduced number like we had yesterday when we only had 6 as opposed to 10 or even 2 series of 10 as we first started with. But yeah, you know, I agree with a lot of the people who've been talking this morning about the debate who have said, well, I don't know if it really changes much at all, at least in terms of the equations that are racing through the heads of voters in Iowa and, of course, in New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, the 4 earliest states. And there are 3 weeks left until people start caucusing in Iowa, and a lot can happen in that period of time. So any polls that we've seen, Arnie, they are, of course, snapshots in time, and we got a lot of time left before that first caucus and that first primary in a state I think you know a little bit about.
Yeah.
And we could definitely see some movement, but not necessarily as a result of last night's debate. There wasn't one of those proverbial flashpoint moments.
So it's really fascinating. So I mentioned to Bob Henley that I had just gone to Axios to sort of see people's reactions to this debate last night. And I think they were interviewing four or five professors. Listen to this question, because this guy must be my cousin. It says, who failed to make an impression last night? And one of the professors said, Deval Patrick. And the reason I'm laughing at this is that for those of you who don't know, Deval Patrick, the former governor of Massachusetts, is running for president. He was not on the stage. He announced very, very late. He is still running for president. He's spending most of his time in New Hampshire. You won't believe this, but guess what I did or tried to do yesterday? I tried to reach out to Deval Patrick and get him on the air today, because I wanted Deval, since he's technically still the only person of color running for president in this 2020 campaign, although nobody would know it. And as they said, Deval who? Because he was not on the stage. I wanted him to respond to the debate last night and say, what would you have offered that you didn't hear last night? You know, and unfortunately, he's in transit, so he wasn't able to do that. But I do think that the stage was missing something, only because it is a non-diverse stage. It's, you know, basically it is all white. And I think I miss the Cory Bookers. I miss the Andrew Yangs to a large extent. They offer more than just a diversity visually. They actually change the conversation. And what you saw happen yesterday, I think, was what happens when you drain that diversity out of a Democratic field that really is so dependent on that.
Yeah, and Deval Patrick, Andrew Yang, Tulsi Gabbard, four or three people who are still in the race, were not on the stage yesterday, and it comes as Julian Castro and Cory Booker have just dropped out in recent days, too. So those are five candidates right there who are candidates of color, if you want to put Kamala Harris, of course, into the group of candidates who have dropped out. She, of course, dropped out a couple months ago, but yeah, it's become a increasingly white field, and if you look at the top-tier candidates, the ones who are polling in the top five at this point, all of them are white men or women, for better or for worse.
For better or for worse. All right. So let's talk about your most recent piece that dropped at the Center for Public Integrity, because I do think people need to know about what's going on with the Federal Election Commission, because everyone knows we have an FEC, but actually, let's be honest, we don't. Can you explain to people why I said that?
The Federal Election Commission, your 10-second history lesson, as it was created in the aftermath of Watergate to basically serve as a cop on the beat for campaign finance issues throughout the nation. Well, 45 years later, the Federal Election Commission, Arnie, doesn't have enough commissioners right now to enforce federal campaign finance law. You have six commissioners, theoretically, who serve there.
Right.
You need four to make any high-level decision. And right now, the FEC has three commissioners who are currently earning their $158,000 a year annual salary, and they can't do much of anything, really, at this point. They can't investigate complaints against candidates and political committees. They can't make rulings. They can't punish people who are scofflaws. They can't go to the end of audits or investigations, and they can't even conduct public meetings and have canceled right now 11 of them last year, and there are none on the schedule at this point. Here we are in the teeth of election 2020, and the cop on the beat is basically just toothless and sidelined at this point.
So
that's the state of play right now.
Right. So is this permissible? I mean, can he literally castrate the Federal Election Commission going into an election where there are so many questions about election integrity? There's so many questions about money and politics. There's so many questions out there, especially, I mean, not that there isn't always that kind of thing, and it's not just at the presidential level, it's across the board. I mean, this also applies to people running for Congress and, you know, those other things. But as you look at this, is he permitted not to give them the next appointment in order for them to at least be able to hold hearings? I mean, to me, this is – how is this legal?
So to your question directly, head on, it – is legal, and it's what we've been experiencing here in Washington, D.C., and by virtue of that across the country since September 1st when the FEC went below that magical four-commissioner quorum in order to conduct high-level business. In our story on Monday, we boiled it down to one case involving Donald Trump.
Yeah,
back in June, the Center for Public Integrity, we reported that there were 10 municipalities across the country that had billed the Trump campaign for police and public safety costs associated with the many, many Trump rallies that have been conducted all across the country ever since Donald Trump started running for re-election on the very day of his inauguration back in 2017. Now, in October, Congressman Bill Pascrell, who is a congressman in New Jersey, he filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission saying that Donald Trump, in his opinion, was acting illegally by not putting these debts, these bills that he had received from various municipalities, including relatively locally to you, Arnie, Burlington, Vermont, on his official Federal Election Commission campaign finance disclosures.
Okay.
People file complaints all the time. Well, the FEC gets back in November to the congressman and says, well, we got your complaint, but we can't do anything about it because we don't have enough commissioners to fully pursue it. So flash forward to the current state of play. Let's ask the question, who is responsible, first and foremost, for nominating Federal Election Commission commissioners so that the FEC would have enough commissioners to rule on this? And wait for it, Arnie, more than 300 other cases that are in the FEC's backlog queue that have not been ruled on or fully investigated. Well, that person is Donald Trump himself. So bottom line, the very person who is the subject of this complaint is also responsible for providing the FEC enough commissioners to investigate this and other complaints. And Donald Trump right now has zero FEC nominees pending before the U.S. Senate, which is responsible in turn for approving those nominees. The FEC is a bipartisan body. Donald Trump's ostensibly responsible for nominating both Republicans and Democrats, or even third-party folks to the FEC, and he just simply doesn't have any pending at this point. I've contacted the White House, and they just declined to comment on what Donald Trump's going to do about this between now and, well, any point in the future, including November, when the election's actually going to take place.
So there is no time requirement that there must be an appointment within 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. The assumption is that, you know, we're supposed to assume good behavior. We're going to assume a rational response from our leader in chief. And the fact of the matter is this is not only convenient for Donald Trump, but it basically builds a moat around him so that any kind of question about financing and his campaign can never get resolved.
Now, it's important to note that the FEC is not a criminal investigation body. It's a civil investigation body. There is no FEC police. There is no FEC gulag. So don't want to overstate the case that the FEC is going to be able to do something that would, be profound in regards to, locking up Donald Trump or somebody else. That being said, the FEC very much is at the tip of the spear for investigating any type of complaint about a political candidate, a political committee, political actors, as it pertains to campaign finance money at a time where election 2020 is going to have billions upon billions of dollars flowing into it and already has, Arnie. So, given that, with that as a backdrop, the fact that the FEC can't go to the end of the road investigating really anything at this point should give great pause to any American who cares about free, fair, open elections where bad actors are being held to task to some degree. Even when, I've been covering this for a long time, Arnie, most people try to do the right thing most of the time, okay?
Yeah.
But it's the bad actors who are looking for a way around the rules, a way around the laws, who are the ones who muck it up. And some pretty funky things can happen during elections, especially when they get heated and competitive. And some people just aren't going to be in that you know, vast great majority. They're going to be the ones who do the wrong thing, and when you don't have the FEC looking into it with full power and full mandate, it becomes very difficult to have as much faith in the quality and the integrity of elections.
Dave Leventhal is the editor-at-large at the Center for Public Integrity. So I have a question for you. So your article is, "Prepare to be Shocked, Trump's One Weird Trick to Avoid a Campaign Investigation." Now, there obviously have been times when there have been vacancies on the FEC. Is this the longest time we have seen a vacancy? What was the second longest time? I mean, has anyone let it go on for months and months? And now it feels like almost years. So I'm just trying to figure out, is this a case of first impression? Have we ever done this before? What was the last time we saw a vacancy, and how long did it take before perhaps Barack Obama had to fill it?
So to review, the FEC right now has three vacancies on the six-member commission.
Three.
The three remaining commissioners, they've all overserved by a country mile their six-year terms.
Oh,
in fact,
God.
Arnie, collectively, the three remaining commissioners have overserved their six-year terms by 30 collective years. Okay?
Whoa.
So they should be replaced too, but they're still there,
God,
because nobody has replaced them. And you can hold Donald Trump, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush, going back that far, accountable for not replacing those whose terms have basically overstayed their terms. Now, to your question of, has this ever happened before? Well, there have been vacancies here and there where a single member has resigned or taken
right.
another job, retired. Usually that person gets replaced in a matter of a few months, okay, historically. There's only been one other time, and this is back in 2008, where the FEC dipped below that threshold of four commissioners that it needs to conduct its high-level business. That was when John McCain and Barack Obama were running for president. And ultimately, John McCain, if you remember, took public funding to run his presidential campaign, something that nobody has done in a general election since among major party candidates. And John McCain, well, what did he need? He needed the FEC to approve the release of public funds so that he could run his campaign. That's only when Republicans and Democrats were able to get together and put enough commissioners on the FEC, because there was a very strong political consideration for John McCain at that point. He ultimately got his money, public money, but that lasted about 6 months, okay?
Wow.
So we're almost to the five-month mark here at the FEC for this lack of a four-member quorum, and there's no there's nothing to indicate, Arnie, that this is going to end anytime soon. I think that one could fairly say at this point that there's a good chance, a decent chance, that the FEC will not be able to enforce federal campaign finance laws during most, if not the entire, 2020 election.
Oh, my God. So let me just repeat something. So there are three vacancies on the FEC. It has dropped
Correct.
Down below four, so they don't have the requisite quorum, so they can't hold meetings, they can't make decisions, they're basically castrated. And the three that are still sitting on there have overstayed their terms by nearly 30 years in total.
Yes. Correct.
Oh my God. I'm just, but you know what this says, David? You and I both know this. I used to serve on the National Board of Common Cause. You know, I always think that, you know, money in politics is something that people need to pay attention to. I'm always worried about the fact that, you know, the lack of transparency, the lack of accountability. We are in this place right now, and now you've got Michael Bloomberg saying, don't even worry about it. I got my own personal $53 billion. I don't even have to worry about campaign finance reform because I am the campaign, and I am the finance, and there's only one check. It's mine. So to a large extent, I feel like people have almost thrown up their hands because they think it's so toxic. They think it's such a swamp, and that there really are no rules for the road. So the fact that there is no FEC isn't going to create an outroar like it should, because we already think the system is so toxic.
And sometimes it takes a massive scandal or something becoming so bad to ultimately get meaningful reform. If people feel that the situation has grown that toxic or bad enough to do something about it. There have been various Democrats clamoring here, especially the week before the 10th anniversary of the Citizens United decision. Mark that on your calendar for the 21st, probably the day the impeachment trial will start
for
Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And And if the FEC just simply sits out election 2020 from an enforcement standpoint, then that may be scandal enough for some meaningful reform to take place, but there's no telling what's going to happen at this point.
Well, you know, I'm glad you came on. I'm glad we did this story. I mean, I knew that they didn't have a quorum. I didn't realize the nature of this and the consequences of this. But at the same time, one of the things that's really, really difficult is there's no one spending. I started this show today by talking about the fact that they spend $1 billion a year, these very, very wealthy conservative billionaires, to basically fight the whole idea of climate change and the climate crisis. Every year, they spend at least $1 billion between lobbying and think tanks and whatever. Nobody is spending money explaining to us what's happening to the FEC. Nobody is explaining to us about the sort of the corruption of the political process because of money and politics. And yet what we are seeing is even as the FEC, which is the enforcement tool, is not capable of doing it because it's been castrated by Donald Trump at the exact right time when he doesn't want them around, when he doesn't want them to have a quorum. And, you know, we're angry about what happened with Ukraine. We're worried about impeachment. This is just one more sort of finger on the hand of toxicity as we go into 2020, and you want people to trust the result. That's what's so sad about this. This just continues to undermine the trust of the result. Dave Leventhal, thank you so much for doing the work on the Center for Public Integrity. And I will post what happened in 2013 when you looked at the consequences of the economic meltdown of 2008. And do me a favor, check out Inside Job and then send me a note. You will be out of your mind when you see it.
Well, thanks, Arnie, and thanks for having me, as always.
You're welcome. Ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and our last song, I love it, is entitled, how appropriate, Money is King.
If a man has money today, people don't care if he has Coco Bay. If a man has money today, people don't care if he has Coco Bay. He can commit murder and get off free. Live in the governor's company. But if you are poor, people tell you, shoo, a dog is better than you. Walks into the store.